Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and this gentleman here is the notorious Jeremy Goldcorn. Today on Cynica, we're very pleased to welcome a scholar whose name and works are familiar to most folks in sinological circles, Professor Jeremy Barmé. Jeremy Barmé first came to China in 1974 during the Criticized Confucius in the Biao campaign and was in China through the final years of the Cultural Revolution. He's the author of many books and essays covering a broad range of topics on history and culture, and he has written and published in both English and Chinese. Some of his better-known titles include In the Red and The Forbidden City. His documentary credits include the highly acclaimed Gate of Heavenly Peace and Morning Sun. He's founding director of the Australian Center on China in the World at the Australian National University in Canberra. Welcome to Cynica, and thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you.
And what brings you to Beijing this time, Jeremy?
Of all things, I'm here. Well, I've been here to launch a bilateral report on the Australia-China relationship that was authored by colleagues in my center and the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, a think tank of the Chinese government. And we just did that launch a couple of days ago.
We'd be very eager to read that and talk about it maybe later on the show. Among the many things that you do, you also edit the China Heritage Quarterly. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you recently devoted an entire issue to West Lake, to Xihu in Hangzhou. As I know next to nothing about Hangzhou besides some overused couplets, which I will not repeat here, the UFA Memorial, which I like quite a little bit. I'm going to hand off to Yumi, and for purposes of clarification, we're not going to call him Jeremy here. We'll just call him Yumi or Yumi, who actually has read quite a bit of the work in the journal that you've edited, Jeremy. Jeremy, or Yumi, your witness.
Thank you, Kaiser. So, Jeremy, perhaps we can set it up first. How did the West Lake at Hangzhou come into being, and who is Mr. Qian?
Well, China actually has many, many West Lakes. Up until the Tang Dynasty, there were really about 30 of them, all called Xihu. The Hangzhou-Xihu won out for a number of reasons. Mostly it was because of about 900, 1020, the local king, it was a period of dynastic confusion and disorder. But there was a local kingdom, nominally under the Tang Dynasty, run by a man called Qian Liu, and he created a series of seawalls to protect the very fertile land around that part of Zhejiang, southern Zhejiang, which is one of the richest agricultural areas in China, the lower Yangtze Valley. And he and his army of soldiers built seawalls, that is, put massive wooden stakes into the ground and balustrades, palisades really, to protect this incredibly fertile land from the very unpredictable waters of the what was called then the Zhejiang River. Now it's called the Qiantangjiang, which would flow down in spring and autumn and often overflow the banks and destroy agricultural land. Again, the most prosperous part of China at that time. And these seawalls also helped create, because of silt and other factors, helped create and shore up a large body of water that was eventually cut off from the river itself. And that body of water, over time, became known as West Lake. And that's the West Lake we have today. So it is literally the creation of hydraulic power, clever local planning, hydraulic agency. And it was also around the same time, the Tang through the Song period, when local bureaucrats and officials would go there, struck by the beauty of the place, also began writing literature, writing poetry and prose around about that lake and that lake area. Very beautiful part of the world, very rich area, so lots of very wealthy people, lots of interesting cultural developments. And so these influences, political, cultural, social, and also environmental, gradually came to create this landscape that's both natural but also partly man-made.
So in the 100 years, though, between the time that Mr. Qian completed his hydrological works and the actual capital's relocation from Kaifeng after the Jurchen invasion in, what, 1126, I guess?
That was a few hundred, 200 years later.
200 years later, right. In that time, prior to the relocation of the capital, was there much of an urban center there? Was it Linan was a flourishing urban center?
Well, Linan is the name that the northern Song gave when they fled south. They created they occupied the city of Hangzhou, which had been known as Hangzhou.
Oh.
They called it Linan, which means temporary peace,
fleeing
from the north. It was already a very vibrant local city, vibrant community, very, very, very wealthy. And we'd already seen famous poets and writers go there who were, as you know, Chinese poets and writers in traditional times, who happen also to be the people who ran the country and ran local administration. And there's a very famous causeway running through the lake, the first major causeway. That is a dike that runs through the northern side of the lake, and it's called Baidi, which was built by Baiji, a Tang Dynasty poet, writer, bureaucrat. And he's commemorated for his helping shore up the lake, protect the lake, dredge the lake, and also develop the local economy. And so his reputation is commemorated by that particular causeway.
Can we go on to discuss the 10 famous sites of the West Lake, which if you go to Hangzhou, tour guides will try to make you visit?
Indeed. It's best, I think, for those who are listening to this podcast, probably the best place to start in discussing the 10 sites, the Shijing of any place in China, is a series of essays by Lu Xun, the wonderful 20th century Chinese writer, who said that China suffers from a Shijing Bing, a 10-site disease. He said there's this appalling practice of adumbrating, of calculating, enumerating sites and scenes that are acceptable at the exclusion of everything else. And he said that Hangzhou was one of the worst offenders, a city and a lake area, 1,000-year-old history, where all of its complex natural phenomena, its complex political, cultural, social phenomena, were reduced in the popular mind, not for those who really want to delve, and I think our journal tries to delve a bit, into these 10 categorized cliched sites. What's particularly interesting about the Hangzhou 10 sites today, and there are other 10 sites you can visit around the lake, mostly around the lake, a couple are not on the lake itself. These official sites, they're like viewpoints. In when you go to any other scenic area in the world, you have viewpoints where people take photographs and they see the appropriate angle of a certain scene. But the 10 sites are themselves partly imaginary. They were mostly invented by poets and writers in the 11th century, 12th century, writing poetry for the imperial family when it moved to the south after the Jurchen invasion. And those sites were ignored for many centuries afterwards. It was only during the Kangxi reign of the Qing period, the Emperor Kangxi traveled south, and the local bureaucrats of Hangzhou wanted to suck up to him and impress him with both their knowledge, but they also wanted to have the official laying on of hands of making Hangzhou an important place, a place where imperial largesse would flow. And so they sent to Beijing a list of all the possible sites in Hangzhou that Kangxi might like to visit when he came south on what was called the Southern Tour. That's a tour of inspection that was also a way of the northern emperor showing that they had cultural understanding and so on. So he gets this list of sites, and he picks 10, and he writes the calligraphy for these 10 sites. And when he gets to Hangzhou, there are these huge stone stelae placed up all around the lake indicating the 10 sites, which since Kangxi's time have been the official viewpoints of Hangzhou and the West Lake. It's interesting, in the last 150 years, there have been 18 sites, there are 20 sites, there are the new 10 sites, there are the new 10 sites. They're all listed in the Heritage Quarterly. We give the whole kit and caboodle. As Lu Xun said, this country suffers too much from the clichéic articulation of sites. Amen. Much better if people just go and discover yourself.
But that's something that hasn't changed at all since Lu Xun was writing.
I'm wary of that. It hasn't changed at all. One can say that about any culture. The Chinese world is particularly fascinating for those of us who work on Chinese culture, history, and thought, in that what is that complex overlay? It's like a piece of cloth, which if folded, you can see all the various layers of it. But are those layers unique, or are they all just piece of one cloth? The Chinese world is constantly changing, constantly complex, and people are able to immediately, through the nature of Chinese language, the way history is commemorated, the way sites and scenes are articulated through cliché, often through cliché, often through a Chinese version of cliché called cheng yu, which is fixed sayings. You both can say that nothing has changed, but at the same time, everyone rediscovers the cliché for themselves, so things do change, and interpretation constantly moves and shifts.
One of the more famous foreign visitors to Hangzhou, or at least a putative visitor, was, of course, Marco Polo, who wrote about the fabled city of Quinsai, I believe this is what he called it, in his travels. Or Rustichello, anyway, wrote about his visions of this beautiful city, where he talks about the absolutely jaw-droppingly beautiful prostitutes and all of this. Is this treated in the China Heritage Quarterly? Is Polo
I mention Marco Polo in one spot. There's a very ugly statue of Marco Polo on the West Lake, on the east side of the West Lake, that was put up with the reconstruction and the refurbishment of the lake in the last 10 years. In fact, we're concentrating, the September issue of our quarterly is called Fakes, Phonies, and Forgeries. And we touch on in that issue the issue of Marco Polo, because Marco Polo has been a cause of great debate in the last 15 years because of Francis Wood wrote a remarkable book on did Marco Polo come to China?
I mean, because of these obvious omissions, I mean, he doesn't speak of bound feet, he doesn't speak of the Chinese writing system, he doesn't speak of chopsticks,
indeed,
the Great Wall. But is there evidence that in his descriptions, I mean, does anything correspond to the realities of Westlake?
Oh, yeah, there are. Okay, and also just in terms of Marco Polo and that whole debate, we'll be reprinting a piece by an old colleague of mine, the man with the wonderful name of Igor Derakovilts, who wrote an extraordinary review of the Wood book 15 years ago, a 60-page review in which he reviews the last 200 years of scholarship on Marco Polo and the work on related to it in Turkish and Russian and French and Japanese, none of which I believe Ms. Wood consulted. It is a very definitive account of Marco Polo as having visited China and been here. But we're interested in the fictions. And as you know, the very nature of dealing with China, it seems to be one of those places where you can write fiction about the place and turn it into fact quite easily.
I've done it myself.
I try to avoid it, but perhaps I've failed.
Maybe one last thing on the West Lake before we go on to the second topic.
You haven't asked about Chairman Mao and West Lake. That's, heaven's sake.
Exactly what I was coming to. Tell us about commies and the West
Lake. Extraordinary history. I mean, the West Lake in the 20th century is extraordinary. I've been rather boring talking about the Qianliu, King Qianliu, and the founding of the West Lake, you know, world. In the 20th century, Sun Yat-sen, Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong were all obsessed. But Sun Yat-sen only went a few times, but he did say a number of very famous things about the place. And he remarked there's a famous tidal wave. It's called the tidal bore, B-O-R-E, that occurs mostly every autumnal and spring solstice, but in particular the autumn. There's a very large wave that goes whooshing by along the Qiantang River, just near West Lake. And that wave, it's called a chao, Qiantang chao, gave its name to the concept of the modern revolution in China. And it's a long story. Please refer to the Heritage Court. There's a long essay on revolution and the tide. And Sun Yat-sen came up with one of his great lines about, because we'll touch on this topic in a moment, great lines about the tide, which was the tide of change is sweeping the world. Those who go with the tide will prosper. Those who oppose it will be destroyed. This is a term and expression. is constantly quoted in China today, talking about the tide of change and China's rise as a power. But Sun Yat-sen was talking, he made this comment when he was in Hangzhou talking about West Lake. Chiang Kai-shek and his new bride, Sun Weiling, went to West Lake for their honeymoon. They stayed in a villa called Chenglu. Sadly, it's not named. It's still there, sitting next to West Lake, but because of the nature of Chiang Kai-shek's reputation in China, still to this day, it doesn't have a big sign outside it. But he went there many times. Mao Zedong himself, he first went there during the foundational period of the Communist Party in the 20s, but he went back in 1953 for his first break from Beijing, and he used it. He used West Lake for many things. He spent sometimes 2-3 months there a year. He used it as a place where he'd be away from Beijing, and anyone wanted to go see him, they'd have to have special permission from the Central Party Office to go to West Lake to see him, so he could avoid all of the complexities in Peking and run things by remote control. So that became one function of West Lake. He had two major residences, West Lake, both on the West Lake itself, very beautiful places. One is called Liuzhuang, the other one is Wangzhuang. They're now open to the public and you can go and stay there. Wangzhuang is my personal favorite. He had very, not lavish, but very finely appointed accommodations there. And he spent many months there. Many of his most famous speeches and comments and articles were written there. The Chinese Constitution was written in Hangzhou. Chairman Mao's famous series of statements about peaceful evolution and opposing the West, those speeches were made at the Dahua Hotel on West Lake in 1959. The basic line that the Chinese government government still pursues today. It's first announced there on the West Lake. The Cultural Revolution was planned on the West Lake. It was mostly run from the West Lake. So it plays a huge role. His last trip there was for his last operation for to correct his cataracts in 1975.
And why we have talked about the appeal over the years, but was there anything in particular that drew Mao Zedong to the West Lake?
Well, not only Mao Zedong, but many other leaders and many people, many tourists, many others. It's an incredibly attractive part of the world. The weather is, it gets hot in the summer, but not too cold in the winter. It is a magical environment. It is a place where, because of its history and its environment, one of those great places in China where long history, literary history, politics, culture, and environment all overlap constantly.
And what about its usages in reform era China? Has it just become something that's been buried under this new sort of chow of sort of money madness, or does it retain some of its romance from the old?
It's one of those, again, a complex place. It is the capital, provincial capital of Zhejiang Province, arguably the wealthiest province in China. It's very close to Shanghai. It's close to all the other major Lower Yangtze Valley urban centers, Suzhou, Wuxi, Nanjing, and so on and so forth. It has played a huge role in the whole transformation of that part of China. Huadong, it is a key center in Huadong. Culturally, it's like a real backwater on many levels, except for art. It is one of the places where the modern 85 movement and modern Chinese art really flourished. As in Beijing, there's the two major centers were Hangzhou and Peking. Zhang Peili, Geng Jianyi, and all these other artists, they all come from Hangzhou. They all still live in Hangzhou. They all travel around the world, but they actually have a home in Hangzhou because they relate to it as a real place. It's not some place where you go because all the foreigners are there. It's not some place you go because all the media is there. It's a place where real creative people actually live to create. And so organic cultural communities actually exist there, which I find very attractive myself.
It's also a center of e-commerce in China, with Alibaba's headquarters being there.
Absolutely.
I actually, some years back, had the opportunity to interview Jack Ma, and it was a bit of a gotcha. It was the summer when Meg Whitman from eBay was actually in town to try to save eBay, which was under threat of being completely overrun and run out of China by a very powerful Taobao. And so I interviewed Jack on a balcony of the Shangri-La Hotel there, overlooking UFA's memorial. And I had been told by his handlers, don't prod him, don't get him to talk all nationalistic. But of course, as soon as he opens his mouth, I needed only to point out that, here we are overlooking a memorial to a patriotic general who fought off foreign invaders. And he just took that and ran with it and started talking about them trying to land their B-52s in our rice paddies and how, Meg Whitman coming to China is like, what, George Bush searching the caves of Tora Bora with an M16 strapped to him. Anyway, it was very amusing. He kept going.
Maybe just the last thing before we move to the next topic. Could you explain the story, Jeremy, of UFA?
UFA. What a mess. UFA. So the Song Dynasty, a wonderful, extraordinary moment in Chinese history from 11th to 13th century, or 11th, 12th century. It is the Song Dynasty is constantly under the pressure. One of the long-term problems in the Chinese world, the world of dynastic politics in China, is that there's been pressures from the north, northwest, northeast since really the second, third century BC. There are invasions because the nomads want the land, the goods, the wealth of the south. Anyway, this group of nomadic warriors, also very cultivated, clever people, called the Jurchen, they found a dynasty called the Jin Dynasty, the Golden or Gold Dynasty, and they established a northern capital and began pressing on the Song. Warfare leads eventually to the northern Song, the Song Dynasty, forced to relocate its capital south, as you were saying earlier, to Lin'an or Hangzhou, to find temporary residence or peace, quiescence in the south. So the capital is moved down into the south in the 11th century, and many of the courtiers and many of the Song Dynasty generals are appalled that they have lost huge amounts of territory to these barbaric invaders. They're not thought of as foreigners because Chinese and foreign, these are modern concepts. They don't exist. But they do regard these as being a dynastic force that is other. And therefore, they oppose it, and they say we must regain our lost territory. Yue Fei, the general, Yue Fei, is one of many, many, many generals, but a leading practitioner, incredibly clever strategist. He trains up a very competent army, and he leads the push to try and regain lost territory. And he says, we cannot be satisfied with finding peace in one quarter of our empire. Pian An is the expression. Han Dynasty expression, still relevant in China because Ma Ying-jeou in Taiwan used it last year to say, we have found peace in one corner of our empire. Mm-hmm. Pian An, Zhengzhi Pian An is a slogan that Ma Ying-jeou uses for Taiwan. Refers back to Yue Fei, refers to the Han Dynasty. Yue Fei tries to lead the forces of the Song Dynasty to oppose the Jurchen, to not negotiate a peace with them, but to press for war. He is betrayed by both the emperor, Gaozong, and by the emperor's other advisors, Qin Hui, depending how you want to pronounce that name. I'm a Qin Hui man myself. And Yue Fei is eventually betrayed, detained, arrested, arraigned, and then executed for betraying the court by refusing to negotiate a peace that will ensure the safety of the Song.
It should be said that his military campaigns were extraordinarily successful. He had pushed all the way back up north, actually, recaptured the north bank of the Yellow River at one point.
Indeed. And so the betrayal at court is regarded as one of the great betrayals in Chinese history, a betrayal of a person loyal, not to the country. He's today regarded as a patriot. Patriotism didn't exist. There's no country. It's loyalty to the court, loyalty to the territory of the imperial family, nothing to do with the country.
And he's the embodiment of loyalty. In fact, he has carved on his back, legend says, the character is Jing Zhong Bao Guo.
Indeed. One of the great non-urban myths, rural myths. But anyway, so Yue Fei stands as being one of these extraordinary figures whose reputation far exceeds what he actually did or what he was. He was, interestingly, very quickly, 20, 30 years after his death, rehabilitated, a temple was built to commemorate him, and he has been a heroic figure in dynastic Chinese history and modern history ever since.
It's a common practice when visiting the memorial, or it used to be, at least in the 80s when I first went, to spit on the statue of Qin Hui.
Absolutely, and they try. They've got signs all over.
They've got
the place
signs all over. Yeah.
Don't spit on the statues.
Anyway, let's move on. That was an excellent discussion. I want to mention when I introduced Professor Parmé, I said that he is director of the Australian Center on China in the World, and it's this precise topic, China in the World, that I want to turn to next and pick Professor Parmé's mind on.
Jeremy, if you could just summarize everything the center.
Yes, everything there is to say, right? Well, I mean, I'll help you frame this a bit, and I might get a little windy, cut me off. Recently, you've had a lot written on China about how it fits or doesn't fit into the modern world order. Some insist that we have to view China as a civilization state, or to quote, I think we have no choice but to quote the late Lucian Pai, who called China a civilization masquerading as a nation state. More recently, people like Martin Jakes in his book When China Rules the World have advocated for this approach. They've gone so far as to say that if we want to understand the world over which China will rule, we need to familiarize ourselves with the old tribute system of yore. meanwhile, we've got other folks like Chaz Freeman, a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, an old China hand with Nixon here in China in the early 70s, writing in The National Interest very, very recently, saying that China is, quote, fully integrated into every aspect of the international system it once sought to overthrow and, in some ways, more devoted to that system than we are. And the CCP leadership itself speaks of China having joined tracks, what's sort of jiegui, with the international system, too. Now, 10 years after accession to the WTO, with World Bank reports being co-authored with respectable party think tanks and recommendations being very seriously discussed, there's reason to believe that that may be the case. Where do your own views fall on this? Are the views of Chinese elites really ready to spring back into this old shape that sees China at the center of the universe?
We established this center on China in the world, which is called Zhonghua Quanqiu Yanju Zhongxin, so that China is Zhonghua, a Chinese-ness, rather than China as in a particular geopolitical territory, People's Republic, Taiwan or Hong Kong, Macau or the Chinese. The Chinese presence, while our argument in establishing this center was that because we're interested in the Chinese experience, the Chinese, what the world of the Chinese universe of thinking about things contributes to human understanding, it is important also economically, politically, socially, in terms of international strategic studies and so on and so forth, to consider the Chinese dimension of things. Just as we think of things to do with Russia or the Arabic world, the world of the Arabic and Muslim lands, of the Americas in particular, the Anglosphere, as many call it, the Anglo-Saxon world of Canada, Australia, America, and Britain, or the Francosphere. These are all global cultures. And so is the Chinese world. And it has been already for a very long time, in particular those who live in Australia. It has been from our very start as a colonized part of the world because of Southeast Asia, the first place that China was becoming integrated in the world and in regional economics. It has a very, very long history. The paradoxes, there are numerous paradoxes. I mean, Chas Freeman is right. Of course, China, the People's Republic of China, is integrated in all of the major international fora, conventions, and institutions of the world. Nonetheless, it still has a government that, as we know, itself is not happy with itself. I mean, no one can even pretend. In China, issues that have been debated and discussed since the late Qing Dynasty to do with what type of country should China be, what should China's guoti, or kokutai, it's a Japanese word introduced in China in the late Qing Dynasty. What type of polity is this? Is it a one-party state? Should it be? Should it be a reformer state that actually allows for greater expression of individual freedoms and so on and so forth? What type of polity, what type of constitution, what type of reformist ethos should lead it to be not only part of the world but make a great and truly civilizational contribution to the world? These issues have bedeviled thinkers, Chinese and non, since the late Qing Dynasty, through the Republic, in the early years, the Maoist, high Maoist years of the People's Republic, less a problem because people were moving in a revolutionary global proletariat revolution direction. But in the last 30 years, these have become issues of more and more importance. And what's fascinating for those of us who are involved with the Chinese world is that the Chinese experience today in the 21st century is one that confronts all people who care about the nature of the human experience, to constantly confront the big issues to do with rights, civil expression, economic rights, pollution and environment. All of these issues are things crystallized and brought into focus constantly by the Chinese experience, and also because the Chinese, both government and society, debate these things in a way and often with a type of, although we don't often see it in the public realm necessarily, with a type of clarity, because the issues aren't resolved. The American and French and German and Australians, we think we've worked out what our systems are, right, what a society is. The conclusions come in. We know where we are. We know where we're going. In China, one of the things that's both terrifying for people involved with China is the lack of certainty.
That's also what's so compelling, that it's in flux.
It's one of the great exciting things that thrills people because it means that human possibility is open. Mm-hmm. And although people feel it's a sclerotic commie system, and you know, as we all know, it can be incredibly dull, but it is also a system that is having to confront all the big questions constantly. I mean, I'm not answering your question really, but these are the things.
No, but that, you are. You know, I mean, you're coming down. You're sticking out a position, sort of in between, which is
the only. We know. Well, it depends on if one is going to get into the minutiae of these debates. You end up taking a position, a different position, depending on which particular thing you're talking about. For example, China's global policy. It's involved in incorporated in the whole global environment. However, in the last 2 years, the Chinese official position on the South China Sea has been quite radical. It has been quite confrontational. It shocked a lot of people. It's actually caused great ructions throughout whole Southeast Asia and East Asia, and also America. It's helped partly elicit America's so-called return to Asia, announced, I would note, in Parliament House in my city, home city of Canberra, the capital mm-hmm. of Australia, much to the shock of many of us. And now the Chinese authorities are rethinking that position. So it's not as though all of the China is just a nice civilized part of our game. We're part all big boys at the table now and everything is concluded and everyone behaves in a very responsible fashion. No, it's not the case. And there are all those resentments. I mean, I'm not a great fan of patriotism or extreme xenophobic behavior in any country or environment. the Chinese authorities and the mass media can do xenophobia as well as anybody, brilliantly, fantastically, because the Chinese language is also a wonderful vehicle for this type of expression. But you do consider the history when even the Communist Party goes on about its history with the West and how it was treated in the past, not the Communist Party, but how China was treated in the past. And if you're at least vaguely aware of what happened in the last 200 years, you cannot but have sympathy for even a political formulation of China's present state. Even if you don't like the way it's put and you don't like the shrill voices, you've got to get the idea that there are good reasons why people think and feel like this.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the conundrum that so many of us find ourselves caught on. I mean, to bring it down to a more micro level, my chief conundrum, having spent the last 16 years here, is while I've recognized that Chinese people are among the most freighted with history, the people who wrestle every day with the ghosts of history more than that, like the Serbians or like the Russians or like, I mean, at the same time, where I feel like they are the most sort of imprisoned by, you know, history's inertia, I also see them as the most malleable, the most mutable, the most incredibly able to reinvent themselves, the people who are least shackled. And on any given day with any given individual, I can change my mind on this topic. And that's one part of the reason that I find China so fascinating.
Well, indeed. And recently, in the last couple of years, there's been a sort of very negative development. People are discussing it all the time. And there was this report on China's economy just released a couple of days ago, discussed much in the New York Times, regarding China's pressing need for China to carry out more serious fundamental economic reform that touches on the big issues to do with social and political reform. Relates to the slogan that has been used for the last few years, Guo Jin Min Tui.
Right.
In the last number of years, the state, the party state under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, has reasserted itself on every level for very good reason, one completely understands. However, the long-term impact is, again, delaying some of the big issues that China has to face as a society, internally and externally. But that doesn't mean that those issues won't enliven debate and discussion.
Let's talk a little bit about communist ideology. I mean, this is something that a few years ago at the USC, US-China Center, you gave a talk where you talked about the Chinese temporal condition. You were comparing it to something that Epstein had written about the Soviet condition, living after the future. I'm not sure. You probably remember this better than I. In China's case, of course, I mean, communism has not been so much relegated to the past, but more of, I think you described it as a parallel present, at least for the faithful, a future as the bourgeois mode of production finishes out its historic mission, maybe. Do you still take this vision of the future at all seriously? Do you think the Chinese elites do? Or are you with those who believe that this is all just sort of, you know, doublespeak and Marxist dialectic? All of this is just vestigial and largely meaningless.
Well, first I'll say what Mikhail Epstein, a Russian philosopher, argued. He said, if we take it that there's a social progress in which you go from feudal society to some form of capitalist society, and then there's a socialist revolution, after which there's an avowed or hoped-for profit communist realization of communist perfect world, then the Soviet Union went from moving through these stages, suppose theoretically, getting to socialism, and then the whole socialist experiment collapsing. And what was once the past, i.e. the bourgeois past of individual production, of bourgeois rights and so on and so forth, became a future because the socialist past had collapsed. And the proffered future of communism became an impossible past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, China is a place where you have this wonderful, it is unique in the world. One can pretend that China is just like everywhere else, but there are unique elements to it. The Chinese mental timescape is unique in that you actually have an avowed, you have a one-party state. Well, a one-party state was supposedly the participation of democratic parties.
Okay, we'll ignore that.
Yeah, that's the line. A one-party state that's avowed aim is to realize a form of communist utopia in the future, yet it's carried out market reforms that relate to a form of international-style neoliberal capitalism. So at any point, the Communist Party and its think tanks and ideologues can draw on the whole range of bourgeois theory and ideas, as well as socialist and Marxist theory and ideas to justify what they want to do, as well as try and think through the conundrums of the present. Now, we see this. This is not just think tanks or individuals and elites arguing or justifying their positions. There is that, but there's more to it than that. And that is that this is a country, and it's an argument I make constantly with colleagues, is the search for wealth and power that people have been on about in China since the late 19th century, wanting to make this world a strong, literally militarily strong country that can fend off all of the former depredations of the mostly Western but also Japanese world, and a wealthy place where the true wealth of the past can be realized once more, is a more profound search, and that is the search for meaning. It's a human search. Everybody does it. Some of us do it by watching lots of Hollywood movies. Others do it through types of music and stuff like that. But the anxiety, and it's a creative anxiety within the Chinese world, is to find out and work out a human meaning. And it's something that still bubbles away constantly in the Chinese world. You just speak to people and they'll talk about it. It's not far below the surface. And that is one of the interesting things that's constantly pushing against all the phony ideology, all the phony neoliberal pursuits of the government and others in China, and makes it enlivening and interesting. In the very practical sense, we've seen in the last couple of years a lot of debate about the revival of red culture through the Bo Xilai Chongqing model. On one level, it's complete showmanship, crap, and power play. On another level, the red traditions, the traditions of Marxism, Leninism, and Maoism, defunct and foolish though they may seem to many, and though they may be seem to be completely discredited, they have within them elements of civil possibility and civic possibility that is not provided by other ordained or condoned elements within the Chinese world. And so the red culture and red thought and red society can actually provide the ethos for opposition to rank corruption, to party dominance, to contempt for the masses of people. And that's a reality. So there are those resources that are there. At the meantime, you've got all these Western discourses of universal values and stuff, which people also want to draw on. In America or in Australia or elsewhere, people don't even think about these things.
That's
here,
right.
You know, here at least you can.
Jeremy, did you have anything? Yumi?
Well, that's a very complex answer. Maybe I would like to ask how much you think in the people who really have the power and money in this country, how much of what they do is a search for meaning, and how much of it is just
cynicism?
They want to hang on to their money and their power.
I'd say both. And it's one of the natures of the human condition is that you can do two or more things at any one time.
Some of us.
Well, I know.
It's a basic rudimentary China survival skill.
I know. It's cute because after all, many of the international calculations about China are one about pure self-interest. The party is only interested in staying in power at any cost. I'm sure that is absolutely true. However, to discount within the Communist Party or those who are aligned with it any sense that they have any greater purpose or sense of being or meaning is to make a major error and to completely misunderstand some of the groundwork and some of the deeper swelling away of ideas and emotions within this world. Because this is a world where all that cynicism, all the bullshit, all the money-making and power play is, of course, a taken. We all know it. We all deal with it all the time. It's a place that can depress you more quickly than, you know, most other places in the world. However, these other things are to be ignored at everyone's peril.
Very good. I've got one more question I'd like to throw at Dr. Barmet here. In one of your better-known books, In the Red, you look at Chinese culture from 89 through the decade of the 90s. I'd like you to pick up a thread from that book, film, Chinese rock music, if you want, literature, what have you, and sort of trace it, you know, follow it along for us through the decade or so since that book came out, how it's survived or hasn't in the internet age.
I occasionally think about that book. One of the reasons I don't write a great deal about contemporary Chinese culture is I felt I said what I could say about the Chinese. The cultural phenomenon that I try to analyze, which is that complex interaction between what we call the party state, the party and government, and non-official culture, and the devil's dance between the two, and how with the aid of international money, mostly Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Japanese money in the first instance in the 80s and 90s, how alternative cultural producers in film and music and art and so on and so forth, how they managed to negotiate a space for themselves while being both manipulating the status quo and being co-opted by it. Now, this is not a phenomenon unique to China. If you know the New York art scene in the 1960s, that's what it was. And my interest was in that book, and my interest has been since then, is how both the clever artists and all the successful ones, the Zhang Yimou's, the Cai Guoqiang's, and those characters. But where does and how does the individual who has a unique purchase on creativity, how do they negotiate a space to live, think, and also develop what I'd call, and what others have called, an organic cultural community? That is, a community where it's not just about producing works for sale, in particularly on the international market or to the new billionaires in China, but where you actually have artistic friends and you look and engage with the work of your friends as part of your actual lived practice. It's not just about making money or becoming famous.
Right.
I live in a community where my friends are mostly artists and writers, and most of their work is about actually being part of a community. In China, there are such groups, but they're not the ones that we hear too much about.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, my book was more
concerned. It's not Sung Zhuang, it's not 798.
You're not going to be finding it there.
Right.
No. One of the worst, Australia is the place, after all, where they first began to, where governments and cultural producers began to create a concept of creative cultural industries imported into China in the mid-2000s, which helped create Sung Zhuang and helped create Qi Ju Ba. Creative cultural industries, which have been, as you know, affirmed by the October 2011 party document on culture,
right,
are a great way to kill off culture, but a great way to make money. And my book, many of the conclusions I drew in the Red still hold firm. One just can change names and change details.
That was my essentially my conclusion, is that things have ebbed and things have flowed, spaces have increased, they've retreated, but we're still dealing essentially with that same set of issues.
And this takes us back to the discussion about the Chinese polity. If basic issues such as protection of certain rights, protection of certain freedoms, real freedom of speech, judicial independence, protection of basic human rights against party control or interference by particular interest groups and so on, if these things aren't resolved, a society, no matter how extraordinary the China is, a society simply cannot mature.
It certainly can't produce culture worthy of
well, because it always has to go back to these same issues. It
That's
has to
right.
return again and again and again. And this is where there is a great difference with the so-called West. And that is, in the West, I was being disparaging before, where we don't discuss certain things, and there's a much more open possibility in China. On another level, basic things about human life have been determined, that there is such a thing as a belief and an institutional practice that's in favor of independent judiciary, independent media, and certain legal practices and protections of the individual. And in China, these things, it's not as though these things aren't discussed. They're discussed all the time, and people are pushing and calling for change. And we know that, which is fantastic. But until some of those basic things are worked out, they weren't worked out in the Republic of China. They definitely weren't worked out in the Qing Dynasty. They haven't been worked out in the People's Republic of China. And they will be one day. But many issues, if not resolved, just force creators and others to return again and again and again to issues that people in the West think, well, we've worked that out.
On that note, I'd like to thank Dr. Jeremy Warme and Jeremy Goldkorn. Let's move on to our recommendations for the week. Why don't we start with you, Jin Yimi?
Sure. Today I'm going to recommend a bird. If you go to Rutan Park or south of it, the embassy, the old embassy area south of it, which has a lot of trees, or the Qijiayuan Diplomatic Compound, you can see the azure-winged magpie, which is a superior bird to the regular magpie. It's got a lovely blue color and a slightly different shape from the magpie. And it's one of those little secret bits of wilderness left in the city of Beijing, which doesn't have too many birds.
Very good. Jeremy, do you have something for us?
Well, if you're...
A bird.
Okay. A bird, not a bird.
A bird, sorry. I know that's a bit of a weird one, but get thee to Rutan and spot the azure-winged magpie.
Or otherwise give Jeremy Goldkorn the bird.
I think there are plenty of people doing that right now.
That happens every day.
I'll just recommend a book that came out last year by the person who taught me modern Chinese and was kind enough to indulge me to ask my supervisor of my PhD thesis many years ago, a man whose pen name is better known than his real name, Simon Lays.
Ah.
His real name is Pierre Rickmans.
Right.
And he produced a volume of collected essays recently called Essays from the Hall of Uselessness. And I would strongly recommend people.
Simon Lay's Essays from the Hall of Uselessness. I've got something fairly small to recommend. The Caixin English site did a series of three interviews with the Oxford historian Timothy Garton Ash. Li Xin did these interviews. They're on video. They were done at Davos, so they're a few weeks old, but they're quite excellent. Mm-hmm. Timothy Garton Ash is a very wise man.
And Li Xin has been a guest on this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely has been. I have to say, Li Xin, you look terrific in these videos. Okay, well, thanks, folks, and thank you very much, Dr. Bermay, for coming in and joining us and lending us your precious time. Jeremy, as always, we will see you folks next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.